This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the last session of Mexico Moving Forward 2015. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers for this third session, Transforming Mexico. Innovations in the private sector and in citizen organization and participation are creating mechanisms for transformational change across Mexico. This panel explores the ways in which entrepreneurship, social media, and investment create new spaces for dialogue and impact. It's my pleasure to introduce my friend and intellectual author of the first Mexico Moving Forward, Alberto Díaz-Calleros, who is a former director of U.S.-Mexican Studies and is now the senior fellow at both the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies and Stanford Center for Innovation in Global Health. His work primarily focuses on federalism, poverty, and economic reform in Latin America, and particularly Mexico. Hernán Fernández is a managing partner at Angel Ventures, one of the founding partners of Angel Ventures Mexico, the leading angel investment network in Mexico. He also has worked for Booz and Company and PricewaterhouseCoopers. Andrea Giralt is the president of Giralt Consulting, where her work focuses on busy strategy, supply chain, manufacturing, and operations management. With more than 20 years of upper management experience, she has managed operations for a number of businesses during periods of both declining sales and rapid growth. And finally, Pepe Marino, who is the director of Data 4 and a professor at the Instituto Tecnológico Autónomo de México. His most recent research focuses on Mexico violence and its causes. In 2013, he founded Data 4, a data consultancy in Mexico for data collection, analysis, management, and visualization. Alberto, te cedo la palabra. Well,
thank you very much, everyone. Buenas tardes a todos. We have the distinct pleasure of having the final panel of a really exciting day full of ideas, and I know that half of the conversation is going on out there, but I promise you that the conversation on this side is going to be really, really interesting and fruitful. I do want to spend 2 minutes before I, you know, let our panelists talk about, you know, this panel is about thinking about civil society and thinking about the private sector and about citizen organizations and citizens in general as transformative forces. That's part of what we want to do here. But I spent a little bit of time this morning as people were debating the Mexico moment. And I like to take long-term historical perspective on things. I think we often concentrate too much on the short term. So I did something which is, you know, most of you do this. You know, you go to Google. So I went to Google, but I did not do just a Google search. I looked for something called an n-gram, the n-gram viewer in Google. Okay, this is a project of the digital humanities, and the idea is they have systematized all human knowledge as it has been put into books for the last 200 years. So anything that has been put in print, in books, you can do searches, and you can search the term Mexico. So I did the search of Mexico in what is called the corpus of Spanish language books and the corpus of English language books. And you can do that if you want, you know, while we're talking. But it turns out that if you do this, there's you know, a really interesting thing that happens between the Mexican moment in Spanish and the Mexican moment in English. Of all the corpus in Spanish, of everything published in Spanish over the last 200 years, the Mexico moment was actually 1910. That's the time when the highest proportion of the words written in Spanish had the word Mexico in it. The next highest was 1997, the next one was 1940, the next one was 1905, and the next one was 1870. I have no idea why. I just want to provoke a little bit about how we think about this Mexico moment. In English, it is very different. In English, actually, it doesn't have a spike in 1810. It's kind of a curve that goes, you know, goes kind of up into the 20th century, and then it sort of fluctuates. And it fluctuates with peaks in 1885, 1940, 1970, and again 1997. The only coincidence between these two is actually what I usually time. Most of my colleagues who are scholars don't necessarily do this, but I timed the Mexican transition to democracy in 1997. Anyway, we're transforming Mexico. So the question is, how do we think about this transformation? Second point I want to, you know, just mention briefly, I don't know if we really understood what we were doing by calling the panel Transforming Mexico. Transformation means that we think we know what the new form will look like. There's a better word, but it is a, you know, obscure, almost theological word, which is metanoia. And that would be a transformation which has some sense of regretting what we have done. That is kind of more the theological meaning of metanoia, or the other metanoia is a change in your minds. And I think there was something of that going on earlier today. You know, with that in mind, I think what part of what's happening here is that we will be able to see what some citizens are doing in their private spheres in that transformation of their own minds. So those are the two points. And the third one is just a comment about our thing up here. I'm sorry, but I do have to defend this. There is some sense that where are we going to get the input for some of the things about moving forward? And it seems to me that we cannot forget that Mexico is a very old country. It is an ancient country in many ways. It has ancient problems as well. Inequality did not start, you know, in the last 50 years or the last 100 years. But the solutions really require that we think about how do we draw from that cultural strength, from the communities that have existed from pre-Hispanic times into the colonial era, into the era of independence, the solidarity between people, which is one of the traits that Mexicans have, hard work and effort, an ethic of hard work and effort, which is part of what Mexicans, you know, pride ourselves at doing, and also illusions and aspirations. We are very imaginative people, and we always think that the future will be better, and I think we have to remember those. But I should stop. We have to get started with Hernán. Please go ahead. The podium is yours, so you can do this from...
Thank you.
And 12, 13 minutes, if possible, please.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much. I'm very, very honored to be here, and thank you for UCSD for hosting us for this fantastic event. So my name is Hernán Fernández. I'm a managing partner for Angel Ventures Mexico, and this truly is a love story about entrepreneurship, because when me and my founder, Alberto Osio, who is actually living here in Coronado, we always make the internal joke that when we drew straws, I got the short one, and so I had to relocate to Mexico City, and Alberto is still living in Coronado. It's a funny story, but we're the only venture capital fund active in Coronado. I mean, that's quite some bragging rights. Long story short, I was fortunate enough to attend MIT, and being there simply changed my whole perspective on how innovation and entrepreneurship are conceived at a whole new level. And basically, we were very much involved with business plan competitions and this fantastic so-called entrepreneurial ecosystem where you have a good idea and capital is very democratic, because you raise your hand and you can have like an attorney coming over to you and telling you how you can structure your idea or file for a patent. You have an accountant help you with your finance. You have all of these support network of mentors, investors, etc. So it's simply, you know, like mind-blowing the support mechanism that you have there. So when we started this back in 2007, our challenge were like, okay, we want to make this happen in Mexico. We have so many people that are requiring some sort of like finance for a brilliant idea, many of our classmates, etc. And I was like, we did like a very small social experiment. And we said, hey, Alberto, you and I, we both know people who are looking for money, right? Yeah, you know, entrepreneurs. And this guy, he's like a former McKinsey guy, or he just like quit Goldman or whatever. I was like, yeah, sure, okay. And we all both know people who have money, right? Yeah, and they're always complaining how they're just bored about like doing real estate investments, and you know they have just invested in their sixth like Subway sandwich franchise, etc. Like, okay, so why don't we get them together and see what happens? And thus, Angel Ventures was started at Alberto's mother's house back in 2008. And the premise was very simple. We just invited them to have a breakfast, and we put the people with the money and entrepreneurs, right? And we told them, okay, guys, there's a surprise. These three gentlemen right here are going to use 10, 15 minutes of your time and presenting a story. And sparks flew. Entrepreneurs are really self-proposed, very driven individuals. And the people with the money were just like amazed to see the potential of early stage investment. So nobody wrote a check that day. But I'll tell you a little bit more about how this love story is still going on with entrepreneurs and trying to finance early stage innovation. So Mexico and innovation, it's really happening. Right now, I mean, Mexico has really strided in places of increasing in terms of ranking, competitiveness, entrepreneurship, the whole like doing business, the leadership boards and everything. I think Mexico is really well poised in order to grasp this entrepreneurship. We have climbed so many places from the global rank, eased a lot of restrictions on starting a business, etc. And as previously was said, we have so many like international trade agreements and even like the rule of law in terms of everything that has to do in running a business has been increased. And we are far better than many of our peers in Latin America. So that's kind of like the exciting news for becoming an entrepreneur. This is the Inter-American Development Bank. They have seen kind of like what is the current landscape in order to finance entrepreneurship and innovation in the country. We do have like a buoyant class of entrepreneurs looking for these new ideas, right? We're all hunting down for the Mexican unicorn. And here's a story for Tijuana. Turns out that the only Mexican unicorn at the moment is currently from Tijuana. And it's a company called 3D Robotics, started by a guy named Jordi Muñoz. Jordi is probably now 22, 23 years old. And how he came to be discovered is a really interesting story, because this guy simply was disassembling Nintendo Wii's and then setting up drones. And whenever Chris Anderson, the chief editor at the Wired magazine, he was playing around with his children, and they start like, you know, trying to participate of this like maker space and drone thing, and so he just went out to the community and said, okay, I really want like someone to teach me about these drones and everything. Who can the community of Wired magazine can point out to? And then the name Jordi Muñoz was selected, right? And Chris was generally intrigued, and he invited Jordi over for lunch, and he was amazed to see this 20-something, you know, like guys, scruffy looking, just trying to disassemble drones. And now it's a company that, obviously, in venture capital and in the Silicon Valley terms, a lot of this is paper money. But now it's a company that's portrayed to be worth $1 billion. And it was started by a Tijuana kid. It has manufacturing operations in Tijuana. It has a commercial office in San Diego. And HQ, it's still in Silicon Valley. So it is amazing what's going on here, right? Like, I mean, some years ago, you cannot think that, you know, something built out of a garage could be worth so much. But now, to be honest, that's the new standard. Now we're looking into companies like Uber that is worth $61 billion. It's definitely the most valuable transportation company in the world. And you know how many cars Uber actually owns? Zero, not that many. Think about Airbnb. Airbnb is now worth more than any single like hotelier chain in the world. How many hotels or rooms does Airbnb own? None. The most important media company in the world, his name is Facebook. Which content actually Facebook owns? None. Impressive. The whole sharing economy is here to stay. And I think that the people who are poised to really take advantage of this are millennials, and they're the entrepreneurs. And if we're thinking about the Mexico moment, then for certain there is some people that we as a society cannot afford that they miss out on the Mexican moment, and that those are our entrepreneurs. So the good news is entrepreneurship is definitely flourishing. There's better corporate governance and accounting standards, and we're starting to get attention. And there's also more and more entrepreneurs starting to understand VC. And when I graduated from MIT, like the hot job was to work at McKinsey or like any of the consulting firms, etc. Now, more or less one out of three people coming back from the MBA are thinking about like doing their own startup. So definitely now more and more becoming an entrepreneur or the founder of a startup is a career path of choice, which is quite interesting. And then we also have angel groups starting, incubators on the rise, and funds with tracking, only in private equity, but more and more they're migrating to early stage and VC. So just, I'm probably going to skip through many of these slides, but now there's currently 37 venture capital funds in the country. And 10 years ago, that was probably one or two. 5 years ago, when we started, we were only eight of us, and now it's 37. So definitely in terms of sheer numbers, it's amazing. But the bad news is that we still deploy less venture capital than the state of Utah. So the country of Mexico still deploys less venture capital than the state of Utah. So there's still a long way to go. So this is a little bit more about the how many funds have been raised by venture capital and the commitments allocated to Mexico. More and more, thanks to INADEM and many of their policies, there have been a growing number of seed venture capital funds. Still too early in the game to see if they're going to be successful or not. And obviously, a lot of this is allocated towards internet technologies. We also have a very important percentage of that going to medical, health, and life sciences, and among others. And obviously, IT encompasses all the way from fintech, which is financial technologies, which is a very interesting current trend, all the way to health tech and some of these IT-enabled sectors. So, yeah, the VC industry right now is $1.08 billion in Mexico, approximately. It's sometimes hard to get some of these numbers. 248 more money invested than in previous year, we're talking 2015. More transactions than the total number for the previous 12 years in the past 2 years. Seed transactions obviously are becoming more and more relevant, and $355 million raised with 37 active managers in the region. So this is the venture capital cycle, and it's important to understand it because, you know, first you have have you heard about the term, probably we're in California, so you probably must, friends, family, and? No, come on, no fools, it's fans. Come on, you guys. This first part where you have like R&D and the government obviously has a lot of support in this, and then you have a very early stage phases when you have like your whole friends and family network, which is traditionally called friends, family, and fools, but we need to call them fans more and more because Mexico has a really big problem with failure and zero tolerance to failure. And I think that's one of the traditional things about why Mexican entrepreneurs are probably thriving more and more. It's hard to think about like a reason, but the only thing that I can get when I see a guy who is probably 22 or 23 years old is that he's not an hijo de la crisis, like probably my age or some other guys, right? Back in like the last big crisis that had, like I don't know, came like wildfire to us was back in 95. So probably people that were too young at that point in time did not experience that crisis, and it's a truly a golden generation of self-driven entrepreneurs that are driving a lot of these Mexican entrepreneurial moments. So that's very exciting. And on the other end, in terms of financing, what's really interesting to see also is like people now in 40, 45, which comprise most of the angel investors that we work with, these guys are most of them CEOs, CTOs, CMOs of different companies. And it's very interesting to talk to them and ask them what were they're doing back in 99. And many of them were trying to become entrepreneurs themselves. So they had their own companies and they were trying to run a business. And then the crisis hit, the internet crisis, because many of these guys were trying to do internet stuff. And then they tried to do chambitas here and there, you know, like trying to get like a small client to pay for the fees. But particularly the ones that were married, you know, at some point they got summoned by the wives or spouses or whatever, and told them like, honey, I love you, but either you grow up and get a real job or we're getting a divorce. So it's impressive to see how many of these people actually, and I was discussing this with Claudio, The entrepreneurial skill set gives you so many advantages over the competition because you are driven. You need to find clients. You need to talk to customers. You need to convince a lot of people. So obviously, these people thrive in their corporate settings. Now, 10 years later, their opportunity cost to become entrepreneurs is actually really high. But you know what these guys are great doing at now? Angel investors. And one thing that we have lacked in our country traditionally because there are not enough successful entrepreneurs who will go through that financing cycle and have enough money to invest into the new generation of entrepreneurs. So the next big thing, and actually right now there's a critical mass ready to invest as well, is many of these failed entrepreneurs at some point who now went to the corporate job, they have a decent salary, and they have something that they did not have back then, which is disposable income. And they are really smart in what they do. So trying to amass these components of Mexican society and to fund the new generation of entrepreneurs is something that we as a society need to really encourage into happening. So the venture capital life cycle talks a little bit more about R&D startup early stage, and we're relevant at the early stage, and there's more funds towards us. We currently also manage a $20 million fund. So what we saw is many of these individuals who are investing of their own money, we actually wanted to partner out with them and write bigger checks in order to make businesses thrive. So currently our biggest transaction can be as much as $2 million. But we have the CEO of Google or the CFO of Pfizer, the CMO of Cinepolis probably becoming investors into one deal into our fund. So it's amazing because our fund not only benefits from the great investors that currently are in the country, but also from fantastic co-investors. And that's kind of our thesis. And obviously, I think that the ecosystem is right. And finally, what I would like to end my participation right now is this is the value of debt. This is the value of debt for entrepreneurs. And this is the common enemy that the whole ecosystem we're facing. Because as I said first, when you're in the phase of project creation and project or company creation, you probably need between $10,000 or $50,000, right? So for many middle-class individuals, probably that's fairly easy to get. You go with your college friends or you go with your rich uncle, hope you there is one or something. It's probably fairly accessible to get that kind of capital. So to get that kind of like proof of concept, it's actually fairly easy to do. Then it starts getting more complicated because when you need $50,000 to $200,000, then you definitely need a rich uncle, right? But that's kind of like where angel investors actually, that's their sphere of influence. And sometimes an angel investor is closer than you expect. It can be your former boss. It can be, like that classmate who was wealthy or that did it really well in investment banking or whatever. So getting $50,000 or $200,000 still is possible. And obviously, most government programs are focusing this target. But then we have a problem, and that's the so-called financing gap. It's also been documented in economics as El Valle de la Muerte, the financing gap, the missing middle. And this is because, and that's where we're stuck in Mexico, when you need between $200,000 and $2 million, it starts to get a lot more complicated to get people who actually have this kind of money to invest. And when you go to funds, which funds are all the way to the left, funds survive or behave on certain economics that they usually charge 2 or 3% of money under management. So in order for them to deploy money, you have to be a ticket that is worth $3 or $4 million. So this whole space between $200,000 and arguably $2 or $3 million is really hard to get. And that's kind of like where we stand in this fight. We are aiming to try to create many of these high net worth individuals, the first generation of successful entrepreneurs that have some money now to invest, and even family office, etc., to try to work together in order to help finance this gap. Because the funds at the other end, they're waiting for many of these output to be the promising companies of the future. But if we don't work together, and there's obviously a lot of public policy and everything to be created into this, then we're going to really miss on the Mexican moment, at least in what concerns two entrepreneurs. So on my end, thank you very much.
Thank you. Excellent. Thank you, Hernan. So let's continue with Andrea.
Thank you, Melissa, Peter Cowell, Alberto, Manuel, for making this happen, and to all of you for making this experience possible. I thought I would talk today about what I do, what I learned through my career, and the outlook, what I see happening. What I do, I help small and medium-sized companies better manage their operations. It is an end-to-end approach that starts with the understanding of the company's strategy and competitive advantage to the reengineering of their operations, looking at organizational structure, processes, and its competitive position from manufacturing and supply chain perspective. My experience comes from riding the innovation cycle and its transformative forces of the inkjet technology, a high-volume business that experienced an incredible rapid growth and went through its maturity and decline. Let me walk you through the evolution of that life cycle and my participation in that journey, what I called the four transformations. The first one, internal manufacturing to outsourcing. At the time, the 90s to 2000s, right, I was in Europe. The technology adoption cycle was in the rapid growth phase, and everything we built, we sold. But internal manufacturing was not easy. We had to train the supplier base in the meaning of high volume and tight tolerances. And the pool of choice was the automotive industry, which we had to transform. Growth was the driver of outsourcing, and it's been for many companies. First, in my case, the Czech Republic, then Hungary. And what did I learn in this first transformation? That outsourcing, it is not just handoff of manufacturing to a third partner. It is a lot of work. And the organization be better prepared for it. You first need to understand the product, the technologies you're driving, to be able to transfer that to a third partner. If you don't understand that well, it will pay you in terms of market, time to market, quality, and resources. The training and selection of the supplier base requires effort, and especially when you're managing high volume and you're landing that in a country, there's no perfect match. It's really a lot of effort. Another thing I learned is that the organizations need to morph. They need to let go responsibilities, understand which ones are duplications, and learn to manage through others, manage others to your strategy. That is not easy. The move to the Czech Republic did not go really well, mainly because the partner we selected had no experience. The second move was really interesting. We created an ecosystem with three very experienced CMs, vertically integrated, and vendor-managed inventory for components from Asia. It was a very sophisticated supply chain that was very competitive. At that time, what became really interesting to me was the meaning of the job multiplier. Every job we were creating in manufacturing was translating into 60 times in terms of the numbers of jobs that we were creating. And when you're managing high volume, you really are transforming those countries. But what happened around 1999 is what I called the second transformation, from regional to global. Regional is you're producing the region and you're selling the region. Global, the world is out there. What happened at that moment? The attractive tax incentives on foreign investments, low labor rates and favorable tax exchange rates in Asia moved the needle. Also, to my friend in the front seat, the oil barrel was at $30, which was really attractive. And we all went there. We all went to Asia, right? What was I in terms of the technology innovation cycle? In terms of the inkjet business, we were entering the maturity. And what does it mean? It meant for us expansion, portfolio proliferations, discovering the emerging countries, And the challenge was then in the supply chain. It moved from manufacturing to supply chain. What are the key learnings for me through that phase? The concept of vanilla, and I'm not talking about the scents. I'm talking about a generic unit and how you define that generic unit. Basically, it was a two-step manufacturing process. You have the generic unit in Asia, and then you localize in the region, a second manufacturing step, with the objective of minimizing the overall manufacturing cost, but at least at the same time achieve service levels by late point differentiation. And what does it mean at that time? Because everything was so inexpensive, and we were doing it as fast and covering so much extent in terms of countries, that we basically went really complex. And the second learning for me was the ghost metric, the cost of inventory, inventory-driven cost. Where does it show? It doesn't show on your P&L. It's the cost, it's a cost that you pay, but it's up there. What happened in the industry? Everybody was carrying tons of inventories in their supply chain. In general, that architecture of multiple complexity as corporations was made us difficult to understand the overall cost of the operation. And what do we start seeing as well during this phase? The beginning of R&D outsourcing, co-located offshore. So first, this is a progression, manufacturing outsourcing, then R&D outsourcing. It's progressive outsourcing. What comes next? Global to virtual. What happened around 2009? Basically the post-recession, right? In terms of the inject business, we were approaching the decline. We are still global, still in Asia. We invested so much in it. We were everywhere, Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, China. But the recession hit us hard, and hit us hard to all of us. And so what would we need to do? Cut, and cut, right? Cut partners, consolidation of CMs, cut costs, rationalization of portfolios, cut people, layoffs and reorganizations, and the creation of the virtual organization. And what is a virtual organization? You know that when you're working 5 a.m. to 5 a.m. 7 days a week. If that is your case, you are in a virtual organization. During this period, I was responsible of $2 billion in cost of sales, consolidating partners, 80% of the business in one partner, and managing a team spread all over the world. And what was going on in Asia, particularly in China? China labor rates increases 20% a year. Skilled labor is in high demand. And the lack of operator in coastal areas forced everybody to move inland, which means longer supply chains, more cost. On top of that, 5% increase per year in inflation, your raw materials become more expensive. 5% increase in logistics and a little bit of unpredictability there. Because if you remember, the barrel of oil plummeted in 2008 from 140 to 44, but then went up again to 100. So how do you manage the cost of your supply chains if your cost is moving so much? So what do I see next? The challenge. Rapid innovation, that is what I'm seeing right now. The speed of innovation in the consumer market is unprecedented. Robotics, the Internet of Things for recreation or for health, new materials, new disciplines, together with a vivid consumer. A consumer that can wait and wants the latest innovation as a way of living, as an expression of themselves. How many devices do you have at home? You have a new cell and you're researching, you're doing Google searches about the next one? Yes, that's us these days. Fashion and designs become really important as those devices live with us. We wear them. And the competition is fearless. There are many copycats, so IT protection becomes really relevant. Time to market is critical, and the life cycles of the products are really short. What happens with the life cycles are short? Difficult to manage your inventories, difficult to be good in your financials. How to compete, innovate fast, and control your inventories. And what is relevant? Time to market. With that in mind, the outlook. Mexico and the U.S. are very well positioned to offer value. Rapid innovation needs quick iteration cycles, and proximity of R&D to manufacturers offers that opportunity. That really will shorten your innovation cycles and launching those products out fast. Short life cycles require tight management of inventories and acute pulse of demand to avoid excess and limit your end-of-life discounts. Very critical, especially if it's fashion that is involved with it. Consumers can wait, the competition is fast, and the IP protection is critical. Better control when it's in our region. China is too expensive and at capacity. Labor rates are in the order of $3.10, which are 19% more expensive than in Mexico. And on top of that, US and Mexico have a history of manufacturing. We know how to do it. We moved everything to China and Asia in the 2000s, but we've done it. So now to the universities and community colleges and governments, the industry will come, and actually is coming, because the opportunity is real. Now the challenge is on our end to get the talent in line. There are new technologies, new advances in manufacturing and how to do things, new advances in IT. We need to really invest in talent. And to the governments, let's continue cooperating, but as a region. Thank you.
Gracias, Andrea. Pepe, please.
Well, if you don't mind, I'm going to walk a little bit. I'm a bit of a jumping bean. Well, I'm a political scientist, so that's kind of a weird profile to be in this panel. But I also have a company that I opened 3 years ago. And I really struggle about this presentation and exactly what I wanted to talk about to you. First, I thought, like, maybe I should talk about what the company does for money. But that's not, I mean, it's fun, but I don't know how interesting it is. I mean, we do information management platforms for companies and organizations. We do sports analytics. I'm a big soccer fan. And we do econometric analysis. But the company also does a lot of stuff for love. And the things that we do for love are related to things that are not often talked in the technology and data ecosystem. So we have one foot in this optimistic world of technology, and sky's the limit, and, you know, programmers and languages, and everything can be done, and mobile devices. And we have another foot in what's actually happening in Mexico, and it's pretty painful and dramatic. And one of our obsessions is violence in Mexico. And you've seen this graph, I'm sure, 100 times. That's total homicides and homicide rate, total on top and far gone on the bottom. And that means there's been more than 163 total homicides in Mexico since 2006, more than 100,000 of those with a gun. And for us, it's, like, how do we do what we're doing when, you know, Mexico City is a peaceful and, you know, happy place for the most part. But how can we do all this technology and do all these data visualizations and digital solutions and completely disregard what's going on out there? And this violence is not distributed randomly. These people on top are young males. These two lines are males between 26 and 40 and males between 18 and 25. So while the average homicide rate in Mexico was 24 in 2011, for young males was above 60. And it's very unequally distributed. And it's also very unequally distributed in terms of the profile of the victims. You see this line, which is clearly an outlier in terms of violence, that's males who didn't even finish elementary school, who have a homicide rate above 300. That's five times the homicide rate of the most violent country in the world, which is Honduras. So this leads us to have a lot of questions, like thinking, how is this? Okay, we knew that, you know, violence is not distributed randomly, but why is so non-random? Why are these males almost targeted for dying in violent ways? And that leads us to some research, and we find out that, for instance, free toll federal roads play a key role in the expansion of violence. We did another research on social cohesiveness and violence and, you know, which way it goes, you know. We discovered that violence breaks social cohesiveness, and then once this is broken, violence has a life of its own. But that's more of research. But this is the country where we're asking, how can we use data and technology for change? And we don't have many answers yet. We have some. But this led us to be very interested in another topic in Mexico that was very under-talked at the time, which was missing Mexicans. And this began because we found something very weird in a town in Zacatecas called Momax. And we knew there was a database in Gobernación, because they told us there was a database, but they never released it. And they released it in August 2014. They built interface where you can search for people. And we hack it. Once, we hack it twice, and we hack it three times. And we made it public. Because for us, it's an important issue, and it doesn't make any sense to, you know, for the government to keep this information. We didn't release names, we didn't release images, just the cases, in a very clean, is ready to use database. And we discovered many things. And as you can see, disappearances are also not random. This is the accumulated homicide from 2007 to 2012, and this is the disappearing accumulated rate as well. And you already can see that, you know, the probability of going missing, if that makes sense, is not the same if you live in Chiapas, Campeche, or Oaxaca, than if you live in Tamaulipas, Jalisco, Aguascalientes, Sinaloa, of course, Chihuahua, and parts of Sonora. And so, going missing and violence is closely related statistically. This is very big because you have very few observations here. This is homicide rates that are above and beyond anything that you can think of. But, you know, this is 100. You know, that homicide rate per 100,000 people. So this is where most municipalities in Mexico are. These are clearly outliers. And it's a significant relation controlling by everything that you can control for at the 99%. And as of September 25th of 2014, there were 22,268 missing Mexicans. And that's the moment where we just finished cleaning the database and we made it public. And the next day, you know what happens. And what happens is Iguala. And, well, I'm not going to go over how horrible of an episode that was. But the fact that these 43 students from Ayotzinapa, which is a public school, a very impoverished public school, where every year they go out and they fight for public funding for the university, and they use what some people find not very acceptable tactics, you know, like stealing buses and, you know, going to Mexico City and protest and blocking streets, etc. But what these 43 students who are still missing have, it's a face, it's a name, and it's family and friends still trying to find them. And that put... Thank you. And that put the whole missing Mexican to a new perspective. This number that we were talking about, I think, takes a completely different meaning once Iguala happened. And we've tried so many ways to actually wait and convey this information, we wrote a piece in Nexos, which is an important magazine in Mexico, where every character in the text was one missing Mexican. You know, we have experimented with ways to communicate what this means, but what is clear is that nothing could remain the same in Mexico after Iguala. And there are focal points. As soon as this happened, I was in a group in Telegram, which has better security than WhatsApp, and of people that I met in Twitter, where I'm very active. You don't have to follow me. I tweet a lot. And who also protest a lot. And in that group, this hashtag was created, Fue el Estado. It's not my making, so I'm not taking any credit on this. But they recollected money in this group, and you deposit in a bank account so that this could happen, which is a very simple street hack. It's just writing a huge sign in El Zócalo in the second march. The first march was in October 20th. This is the second one. You know, they didn't get much coverage except for the fact that it said this, which is Fue el Estado, which is a big statement to make about. And it's, you know, I could go hours and hours about why Fue el Estado is an important and brilliant statement, but it clearly resonated in our minds. And so we went, when it was the 6-month anniversary, and we scrapped all the tweets and data from Twitter to see how big of a, you know, a splash this made. And there were 21 protests in the first 6 months, and between 133,000 and 392,000 people marched in the streets. The government, for some reason, always underestimates, and the organizers probably, for obvious reasons, overestimate, but, you know, it's a lot of people in the streets of Mexico City. 21 marches, it tells you of a, you know, lingering energy released by this. There were also events, the hashtag was Acción Global, perdón, por Ayotzinapa. There were events and march and, you know, some kind of... what we took is the case where they used the hashtag, but they did something in the streets. It's not just someone tweeting. They had an event in the public square. They had an event in a school in 168 cities in Mexico, 76 cities in the U.S., which is crazy for something that happened in Mexico. I cut Alaska off because of the size, but also in Alaska and Hawaii. 39 cities in Latin America. 79 cities all over the world had some sort of public display of solidarity, of including Western Sahara. I mean, places that you wouldn't even think, you know, they have any idea of what's going on. And the question we had at that point is, like, how could this happen? Like, I mean, of course we understand it's a huge event, it's a tragic event, it's horrible, but is it driven by social networks? What could happen otherwise? And let's take a quick look at the Mexican media. We did a study along with Article 19, where we, for a whole year, we saw the cover of every Mexican national newspaper, and then we divide the cover. The cover is a finite space, right? So you can say 40% of the space is a photograph, 60% of the space is a story, you know? And we classify all the stories into basic categories. Sayings, which means the story is only based in one person statement, no two person, no context information, nothing. Just one person making a statement. And a fact. And if, you know, if you say a saying and you say another saying, we say that's a fact. Just our interest was to really isolate the saying part. You know, how many stories are actually based on one perspective. And as you can see, more than 35% of the covers of Mexican newspapers are sayings, are based on one person statements. There is variance among newspapers, you know, Sol de Mexico is really out there with the sayings. And Reforma is clearly the one who has more facts in the cover. But that already tells you the kind of journalism that happened, at least the first year of Peña Nieto's administration. Who do they talk about? This is the president, this is the legislator, and this is local governments. Local governments are really absent, at least in the covers. And they really talk a lot about the executive, includes the president and the ministers. And what they talk about Pacto por México, which is the year that, you know, it's happening. But they clearly not talk about violence in that whole year. Like, that was not happening until it happened. So why Iguala happened? I mean, what does it say about the Mexican state and the Mexican democracy? And I actually devoted quite a time about thinking about this. And I come up with some ideas, but I guess the main point is well, there are many points, but I, you know, there was a fight here between what reform was the most important one. And I actually think that the most important reform hasn't happened yet, which is the reform where citizens are actually part of the equations, where citizens have mechanisms of judiciary and political control. And I think there is a selective presence of the state, and it's very puzzling. The same state that is absent in places where this complete lawlessness, if that makes sense, lawlessness, yeah? You find a public school, you find a public clinic, so it's very selective where the state decides to, you know, stay away and where it has a presence. And also in terms of, like, how regionally or geographically is present. So I think we understand the state as an agreement about the public and what you're entitled to, given that you're a citizen and you exercise rights. I think part of the story, but, you know, this is really an opinion piece. I think we have substituted the public, what you're entitled by birthright, with political. Everything passes through the political system in Mexico, and then horrible things happen in there, and then God knows what comes on the other side. You know? You either go to the street and protest, which is the Ayotzinapa students' case, or you use money, you know, or you organize with your neighbors and then you talk to the representative and then you get something done. But it never goes through the institutions. It always goes through political machines. And parties have been very clever on learning this from practices from before the democratic transition. So I think there is a political annihilation of citizens who cannot hold representatives accountable. There is a judicial annihilation, and I'm not going to on about this because I know it sounds very dramatic. But my point is that this annihilation, an actual annihilation of citizens, La Playa, Iguala, Tanguato, Apatzingan, it's very regressive. It does affect that segment of Mexican society who is incapable of exercising the rights. So how do we use technology and data to move forward from this? And let me begin with there is a whole narrative in Mexico now, and there's a whole event in Mexico happening, actually, right now, about open data and open government. And we're very excited, of course. We want the governments to be more efficient, to use more efficiently digital technologies, to release more databases who are usable for more people. But that is not transparency. And that is not accountability. And I think, I'm not saying with bad intentions, but I think this conversation about open data and open government is actually kicking the accountability and the corruption discussion, you know, further away. And let me give you an example, and this is not to attack a person who actually was supposed to be here, but this is Alejandra Lagunes, who is in the presidency, who is in charge of the digital strategy and the open government strategy, and she sent a tweet yesterday or the day before, October 27th, the principles of open government are transparency, accountability, and citizen participation. And then you go and you find out that she hasn't opened her financial statement and her conflict of interest statement. So I do have a hard time buying the, you know, we're not worse off because there are more data sets, of course. Nobody is. But this, you know, this narrative, I think it plays more of a public relations thing often. And it's not really making, you know, those who are preaching about it even open their own statements. So There is an ecosystem in Mexico. There are incredibly talented programmers from ITESO in Guadalajara, from Tecno Monterrey in Monterrey and all over. Jalapa is a big one. Puebla is a big one. Politecnico, UNAM, ITAM, of course. And there are plenty of opportunities, and there's plenty of new startups using these technologies. But part of this has been constrained and captured by governments themselves. And it's this format of hackathonismo and TED Talkismo, which I don't know how to say, where, oh, we go, we talk, and, you know, nothing really happens. And it's just, there are also stories of cooptation and corruption, like Enova, which was like a bright child of these social entrepreneurs, and they took $150 million to put some computers in the Estado de Mexico that have absolutely no effect on education, you know, performance of kids. We actually run a diff-in-diff model to prove that. My point is, we cannot talk about innovation, technology, openness, and change without talking about the state, democracy, equality, justice, and rights. And how can technology change the balance of power between citizens of government and government? That, I think, is the main question. So we decided to split the love and the money. And we just opened an organization called Data Civica, civic data. And we believe there is a gap between data and citizens, and we want to build a bridge between data and citizens. So we have two projects, and this is going to be the end, I promise. We have two platforms that we're building. We're our own resources. Nobody's paying us to do this. If someone wants to pay, I can give you my card. So this is a platform called Crime at Hand, because as you heard in the breakfast with the journalists, well, many of you were not there, but it's an issue to get crime data and get it on time and get it clean and get it and cross it with other data. Like, you have 8 different sources, and a journalist or, you know, a non-expert really has a hard time downloading, cleaning, crossing. It's an exhausting process, and we already do it in the company. So we are going to build a platform that has all the data on crime and violence, and you can map it, graph it, explore it, download it in a single place. And it's connected in real time when they release the new information. So I think that's really going to allow journalists who are, they don't have to be data experts. I mean, you cannot, you know, be angry at a journalist because he cannot use his data, for God's sake. You know, it has a different expertise. So we're making it easier for them to use the data and to get their facts easier and right. And you can graph, and, you know, you can also see it as a table. You can download it in Excel, CSV, or DTA. Or you can download the whole, the complete data set. And the other point, talking about the missing Mexicans, is, you know, the more I did these graphs and these visualizations that made it very easy for you to see and play with it, the least I think we had an impact. So I end up reading about adversarial design. And adversarial design is this idea of, like, you use design and you use technology not to solve a problem, but to create one. So our first experiment was this. This is the previous release of the database. So you have profile, you have geography, you have profile, you have many variables, sex, age, body type, nationality, etc. You can drag any of these. But then you have, and then you can subset all the observations, but you don't have a graph in a single screen. There are 23,271 little figures like these ones. And it's exhausting and it's excruciating to go through it. But it's actually one of the visualizations that we've done that has had more impact, because people do scroll down. People do go through the hustle. And then you get some information about each case. You know, this is a 31. We don't know how high he was. He disappeared in 2010. He's a male, et cetera, et cetera. But then after Walla, we thought, like, nothing we do will have an impact until we have names and faces. And I don't want to make public reserve information. I mean, and now they released the database after we hacked it three times. And we have a funny relationship with Gobernación. Like, they know we hacked it, you know, and now they released it and they call us and like, so did you look at it? Yes, we did. So, because we relate to numbers as numbers, not as people. And here the important part is this is people. These are Mexicans that are being looked for, friends and family. So we're building a platform. We're not done with the adopt a desaparecido, but the idea is very simple. We want 23,271 Mexicans to name and put a picture of 23,271 Mexicans who are missing. And it's actually very easy to find them. You can Google and say, missing male, 31 years old, Matamoros, the date that we have. And then it's very likely that you're actually going to find the name and the photo. But doing that 23,000 times by one person, it's not a good idea. And actually, we believe it has to be adversarial design. 23,000 Mexicans should go through the process. So the way it works is you just put two pieces of information, your age and your gender. You send it. And then the database, well, there are images of people who are clearly not missing, but it's a mock-up, like Rosario Robles. Or yeah. But it would subset. I am a 41-year-old male, so if I do that, it's going to show me all the 41-year-old males who are missing. And I would choose one. And we have an instruction, and we have the resources built within the platform. And I would upload my picture. And once I have the name and the picture of this missing Mexican, I would upload it. And we would end up, you know, you can, of course, share it. And we would end up with a field, or that's the purpose at least, you know, with a whole 23,000 faces of people who are still missing and people who actually name them and put an image. And, you know, this is not, it's not radical change, but I think it's it could be a useful exercise for Mexicans to actually empathize and find some sort of closure, I guess. Okay, so final remarks. I think when talking of innovation and technology, people don't want to hear about violence and the state. Trust me. I've been through a lot of places, and you know, it's something that they try to avoid. But I think that when talking of innovation and technology, people should be told about violence and the state. There is in Mexico an ecosystem of techies and activists, and it's people who mostly met each other in Twitter. Twitter is a big thing in Mexico City. Like, almost everything goes through Twitter. And, you know, it's people who started in 2009 in Voto Nulo. There's people who got politically activated when the Yo Soy 132 movement. Then they got to meet, to know each other. They're involved in Fuel Estado. They created this network called Rexiste. We are doing really creative things. There was a beautiful story in The Guardian just a week ago about them. They have this thing called Ladroncita, which is really funny, which is a drone that it goes to all the marches and protests. And they also are part of the MexiLeaks team that, as you know, it has released very important journalistic stories, and is the reason why Aristegui doesn't have a radio show now. And Wikipolitica, which is the force behind Kumamoto's candidacy, for instance. So it's a small, relatively small ecosystem of very young, very active Mexicans who are using technology to empower citizens. And we don't really talk about that side of the equation. And finally, we can improve, I think, the actionability of data by meeting demand and crowd-generating the info that governments will not generate. So, thank you.
So,
We are. Oh.
Yes, you have 15 minutes. Yes. So you choose how to use it.
We're pressed for time. I had three questions I wanted to ask, but I will fold it into one, and then I want to open up, probably pick up two or three questions, and then give them around to discuss or to answer whatever they want. But the one question I want to ask the three of you, sort of trying to fold in, you know, what I thought were three questions, is, you know, we have had this incredibly rich discussion of very different things in this panel, you know, so global to virtual, Internet of Things, the world of logistics and complex contractual relationships in manufacturing and rapid innovation, use of big data for social good, how to make it public, the spread of ideas through social media, data reduction processing, all these questions, the sharing economy, you know, how, you know, do we think of these unicorns, which, you know, quite good as a name for them, because they are mythical creatures, but they are there and they're worth $1 billion. But going back to Claudio's presentation an hour ago, are Mexicans ready for this? I mean, who has the necessary human capital to run manufacturing like Andreas, or to do the entrepreneurship of the people that Hernan works with, or the data visualization and the crowdsourcing that Pepe wants, you know, given the data that Claudio showed us? And on the culture side, I mean, do we need, and this is kind of folding in a second question I had, do we need kind of a cultural shift, you know, get away from this zero tolerance to failure, or what I see as a very risk-averse society, maybe because of all the bad things that have happened historically, or is it just generational shift? Wait, you know, there will be a new generation, or are people flexible enough, you know, or are people secretive and they want to manage and keep information because we have a deep authoritarian culture? So, you know, it's kind of, you know, a bit of a challenge, I think. Cultural change, or can we transform it to education in spite of the things that Claudio showed us in education? So I don't know who wants to take some of this, and then let's start putting the microphone around there. Somebody wants to say something?
Okay, I'll start. Well, what I see in Mexico is I'm really positive about what I see. You know, the automotive industry is just growing fantastically, and there's a lot of reforms going in terms of growing the infrastructure. So Tijuana, there are many examples of companies that are doing very well and are as competitive as Chinese companies. One example is Plantronics. You know, the facilities in Plantronics are fantastic, comparable to all the CMs that I have visited in Asia, where they have their just-in-time, they're bringing tool makers, mold makers to the area. They're already transforming the city with their foreign investments. I also see a lot of entrepreneurs between the two countries, maybe because the recession, we had to get creative and find ways of generating revenue. But there is a lot of talent out there that are coming out with new technologies that they need to find places where they can do these short runs of manufacturing products. And that is an activity that I'm seeing right now. The players, right? So we have the government, the public sector, we have the industry, the universities. We all have a role there. And I think that continuing the dialogue and really investing in areas that will impact, in the first round, the infrastructure and the talent, or the educational piece, is going to be very beneficial. Also, technology, what you were saying, technology just leapfrogs us to a different level. And that is, I think, where we need to really look at technology. Behind technology is always a human being, right? So whatever we do with it, it will come out of our creativity. And the other point I want to make is that U.S. and Mexico, Mexico and U.S., you know, our cultures are intertwined. Look at our population here in the U.S., how many Latinos are here, right? So we can't just only think about countries. We are communities. We are, especially with this aspect of the technology, we are all connected. So there's a strength in that.
Right, yeah. I think on our end, We're definitely seeing some very interesting factors in Mexico. So, for example, Mexico is now graduating more engineers per capita than China or India. And actually, I think it peaked somewhere between 2013 and 2014 that Mexico actually graduated more absolute engineers than the U.S., which will surprise a lot. But I do think that there's really good dynamics in terms of a country that's embracing the opportunity. And we were earlier discussing with Carlos Capistrán about how much impact had the commodity decline in the world. And Mexico was relatively safe because of that. And that's because we're more a service and a manufacturing-driven economy. So there are true fundamentals to think that Mexico is separating itself from the traditional pack that it was associated, you know, like Brazil or Colombia or Peru. And Mexico is truly now like a different country, a different economy. And it's looking more and more to the neighbors to the north. So I think that there are certain things to be excited for. I'm thinking about like how technology is embracing this new kind of society. I for one, I'm really excited what we're seeing, for example, in terms of crowdfunding or all of these like platforms, right? We do this for business, but it's also very interesting to see how big data is not only doing many interesting things to arrange data and open data, but also, for example, in fintech, you know, we're really giving a run for the money for the banks, you know, a very traditional sector, very risk averse, that would not lend. Well, you have now a generation of entrepreneurs that are doing those microloans, that are being faster, swifter, that are assessing data at a velocity that banks could definitely not handle, and right. We are running much of the new financing of the country. We as entrepreneurs, not particularly us, of course, but I think it's exciting what in all the ways that technology is changing the paradigm at a faster pace than a country or than a government can embrace, and that's going to represent a bunch of challenges. And also on that note, crowdfunding, as I said, I think it's something really interesting because, yeah, you now see like the civil society organizing themselves to save Vaquita Marina, and you see very interesting like social campaigns on that. Or one of my personal favorites is this company called Citybox that they organized a mariachi for the 1 year anniversary of a pothole that was in one of these streets in Mexico City, right? So needless to say, like, the government did not take notice, and after this mariachi anniversary song went viral, the pothole next day was out of there. So there are very creative ways how societies organize themselves, and definitely I think that technology is reshaping and enabling many of these players. Unfortunately, not many of these people who live on extreme poverty that probably do not have access to this, and that remains a challenge for our society. But we're now seeing new players in this arena, which was, you know, just dominated by traditional media or traditional players, and now it's more open.
Yeah, Mexico is ready and has been ready for quite a while. I just think we need to make it easier for people to consume information. And in terms of what we do, for instance, with data visualization, if it doesn't work for mobile, it doesn't work at all. Mm-hmm. And it's a challenge. And, internet. You know, the highest growth on internet users or people who can access networks is in mobile. It's not in computers. And also, the media plays still a mediating role, and that's important. That's why I think better use of digital platforms or data journalism is important. And of course, innovation is desirable. I mean, nobody would be against someone opening a company or, you know, a startup. But it is challenging, and I don't think we're talking about the challenges enough from the political perspective. And, you know, if you think of Mexico and the many problems we have, two out of three people working in the informality, you know, either in the formal sector or in the informal sectors without entitlements, with cheap labor, as we saw during the day. And that's exactly the model of companies like Uber, who actually, not only that, they take advantage of non-regulated areas. So I mean, you know, I'm a very anti-Uber activist in Mexico, but because, of course, innovation is a good thing, but innovation brings questions, and it can increase inequality, and it can also put to the test formal institutions of justice and equality that we already agree on, you know, for the last 200 years. So I'm not anti-tech, of course. I live out of technology. But I don't see very often that we have these kind of conversations. And in the case of Mexico, there are incubators, there is programmers, there is a lot of startups, but not many of them are solving problems, which, not all of them have to. But a good example of someone is Jorge Soto, which he's like the poster child of social entrepreneurs in Mexico, who, you know, at some point said, like, I cannot build, I don't want to build an app to take cat selfies. I want to do something. And he's creating a system to detect cancer. Mm-hmm. In early stages using mobile phones, and he's now based in San Francisco. And, you know, there are very good, very successful stories, and you know, we have a lot to learn from them.
Okay, let's take three questions, two questions, one question. One? Okay. You're the one. Yes, sir. Okay, there you are.
Hi, I'm Cecilia Guillon with Kyocera Solar. And I have a question on social media. The first panel was talking about, you know, the lack of transparency, things like that, and the professor was talking about the data. I think it's exciting, and the perfect storm is brewing right now because of all the technology. How do you see social media playing into making this, bringing more transparency, and actually getting the politicians to wake up and to listen, since I heard earlier that they're not? I would like to hear more about what social media can do. And is doing.
I mean, it can do what can do. I mean, I have mixed feelings about it. Like, Twitter is by far the only space of deliberation in Mexico and discussion and contact between citizens and government officials, by far.
Why do you think it's more Twitter than Facebook?
Because of the profile of users and early adopters. I think Twitter in Mexico, when it started in 2008, it was, you know, the users were very politicized, and the more users it gets, the less political it becomes. And you know, then you see the Jonas Brothers and Miley Cyrus, which is fine, you know. But politicians, I mean, and it's also a good platform to get information that you wouldn't get in traditional media outlets. And politicians do care about Twitter. They get very nervous when they get a lot of mentions and a lot of trolling. And for some reason, I thought they would stop caring at some point, and they still care. But I also think that the fact that Twitter is so important talks about how not important formal institutions are for citizens' incidents. And I don't think it's sustainable. Like, we cannot be, you know, complaining in Twitter for 20 years and institutions remain the same. And that's kind of my concern. Like, I'm very happy if I tweet and my delegado pays attention to what I said, but I would rather have everybody being able to go to the delegación and make a point and get the same results, because it's very regressive. Twitter is for, you know, above average income, above average education, and it's actually, you know, it goes against what progressive use of technology would be. But I love Twitter. So.
Okay, well, let me at this point thank our panelists. You know, it's been really a treat to listen to you. One thing I do want to say is, I think it's remarkable throughout the day that even, for example, this panel that you would think is the one most, you know, about entrepreneurship, about technology, about innovation, the awareness of the social issues, I think, has been remarkable through the day in very different guises and very different ways. And the commitment, I think, of everyone around here of, you know, trying to do something about that. And I just want to flag that, because I think everyone had a strong agreement about that in subtle ways and in different ways throughout the panels today. I want to thank all of you. It's been, you've been incredibly, you know, patient and supportive of this process. And of course, you know, I want to thank Melissa and all the UCSD people in general who have made this possible. And I think Graciela probably has to make some words to us, but thank you so much to the panel.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.